Which goes back to another way of saying, one of my friends in China, whom I met in 73, but I had known before, I asked him, how did you manage to keep the lab going and all the people in the institute functioning at the time of the Cultural Revolution, when all the many of the people in the sciences, science institutes, and universities were being sent out into the fields?
He said it was very simple. We set up a factory to make chemicals, biochemicals.
So we were supplying all of the necessary chemicals for a lot of the clinical laboratories of the hospitals. And since we didn't have the foreign currency to buy stuff from abroad anyhow, we had to make all our own biochemicals, like our own amino acids, our own enzymes, and so on, so that I could hold my laboratory together. And we built a whole new factory, a four-story building, to make chemicals for everybody in China. As far as I know, that factory still goes. When I came back from China in 73, I had his price list. And then later on, they were supplying to other countries. They were supplying all of Southeast Asia with these chemicals. For all I know, they may have been supplying Japanese. Who knows? But don't forget, the Japanese have always had a big fermentation industry. Soy sauce, after all, is fermentation. And the major ingredient of soy sauce, one of the major ingredients, is monosodium glutamate. When I was at the Rockefeller, we used to buy our glutamic acid in the form of monosodium glutamate from Ajinomoto, which they isolated from their soybean fermentation. The way we got glutamic acid out of monosodium glutamate was to add hydrochloric acid to it, precipitate it with alcohol to get rid of the sodium ion, and there we had it. Today you put it through a column, of course, and get rid of the sodium. But in those days, we had pure glutamic acid coming from Japan. We're talking about 1940. This is the way we got glutamic acid. So the Japanese, with their fermentation industry, and the fact that their sauces were prepared by using aspergillus, a fungus, whose proteolytic enzyme hydrolyzed the soybean protein, the amino acids were all there. And then you want to isolate them? These days you just put them on a column. You can isolate all of them. And then, of course, when they discovered that the so-called mushroom flavor is inosinic acid, it's after all a derivative of adenylic acid. That's what artificial mushroom flavor is, inosinic acid. So they sell it. It's all Japanese. So that the industrial side of all of this has played an important role. And the institutes in the Soviet Union, I don't know, I'm sure they're making even bigger deals now to survive. They make chemicals and they get money for it. They supply.
But the Japanese activity you're talking about really didn't start occurring that much, that late after World War II, did it?
It started before World War II. As I said, we were buying monosodium glutamate in 1939 and 40 when I was at the Rockefeller. With the war started December 1941.
So what effect did the war have then? Did it just...
It cut it off. And there were American companies that were then making many of these things.
Okay.
But they got cut off.
But then after the war, it reverted back to...
It flooded back in. They had the cheap labor, they had the fermentation industry. The fermentation industry in this country was interested in big money, like making penicillin or streptomycin or equivalent. How did Pfizer become such a power in the antibiotic business? Do you know the story?
Vaguely, I don't know all the details.
Well, Pfizer was a small business in Brooklyn, New York, when the Russians published their way of using fungi to make citric acid. And citric acid, after all, is the most important ingredient in making soda pop. Soda pop in the old days, when I was a child at least, consisted of carbonic acid with a little citrate and a little phosphoric acid in there, plus sometimes a little citronella from the lemon peel to give it a lemon flavor. That was lemon soda. And when a Russian fermentation chemist learned how to inhibit the fungus so that it accumulated huge amounts of citric acid, Pfizer picked this up. They were in the fermentation business making citric acid, for the whole soda pop business of the United States. But they had the aerobic fermentation facilities needed to make penicillin. That's why they were dragged into the penicillin business in 1941, 42. That's the story. From then on, they were a pharmaceutical company. I don't even know whether they still make citrate. Possibly. I have no idea.
Let's return then to the we got sidetracked, which is fine. The glutamate dehydrogenase work, in which you evidently you look for something different again.
We look for something different again. Now that we have the techniques and the methods for studying smaller proteins, it was time to go on to something bigger. Plus the fact that at that time, the amino acid sequence of no dehydrogenase was known. We, as well as everybody else, had realized you started in with the small stuff to go on, develop the know-how and develop the methods and the successes that came with studying the small ones. And I picked glutamate dehydrogenase partly because it was easy to prepare, partly because it was easy to crystallize, and partly because it is one of the key enzymes in all of life. It is a very crucial enzyme. It is the only dehydrogenase that works on an amino acid in mammalian or vertebrate systems. There are other dehydrogenases in various microorganisms that work on amino acids. But in general, in mammalian metabolism, amino acids are degraded, L-amino acids are degraded by transamination to make the keto acid. And the amino groups are transferred to alpha-ketoglutarate to make glutamate. And glutamate is the one that is then dehydrogenated. And it makes alpha-ketoglutarate, which is a component of the Krebs cycle, which is then oxidized in a cyclic form. So in that sense, glutamate is the central amino acid in all of mammalian metabolism. That's why we started. We also knew that it had four peptide chains and that each chain was roughly around 60,000. So we had been dealing with proteins in the 20 to 30,000 range. Now we were going to make the jump to a peptide chain of double the size, and it was quite clear that the four chains of glutamate dehydrogenase were identical. That's it. By the time we were well along, we realized that other laboratories were also studying dehydrogenases. A group in Cambridge was studying lactic dehydrogenase, another group was studying triosphosphate dehydrogenase, and so on. But that's basically the story.
This also continued your evolutionary.
Well, the evolutionary story came a little bit later. The important point about the glutamate dehydrogenase is that it was known from work before we had started in, is that glutamate dehydrogenase is very strongly regulated in terms of its activity. ATP or GTP strongly inhibit glutamate dehydrogenase. ADP or GDP strongly activate it. In other words, our livers, and this is predominantly a liver enzyme, although it's found in other tissues as well, our livers are activated to destroy amino acids when energy's in short supply, when you need to make the triphosphates. And you conserve amino acids when energy supply is plentiful, principally being derived, of course, from carbohydrate or lipid metabolism. So that here we had an enzyme in which we could think of three different kinds of sites to investigate. The active site where the dehydrogenation would take place and transfer the hydrogen to the coenzyme, which would be NAD or NADPH, NADP, or the site where the triphosphate binds in order to inhibit, and the site where the diphosphates bind to activate. And these are called allosteric sites because they're not at the active sites. They change the conformation of the enzyme to increase or decrease activity. So this presents a different kind of challenge than simply studying a proteolytic enzyme, which is not regulated the same way. By the time we had finished the sequence, we had done some labeling so that we actually knew one of the inhibitory sites and had a suspicion as to where one of the activating sites was, and this became an interesting story in itself. Now, the only reason I went immediately into the chicken enzyme is that one of my colleagues at in the chemistry department is an X-ray crystallographer. The mammalian glutamate dehydrogenase gives terrible crystals. They're small needles which are utterly unsuitable for crystallographic study. But the chicken enzyme looked as though it was going to give good crystals. So we said, well, we'll take a look at the chicken enzyme because this will help the crystallography. Well, it turned out it was fairly easy to do the chicken enzyme because it's so homologous to the vertebrate enzyme that there weren't all that many differences. By the time we had finished the thing, it turned out that the chicken enzyme crystals were no damn good either. So we dropped it. But then we went over to Neurospora because Neurospora, like most microorganisms, unlike vertebrates, have two different enzymes that work on glutamate. They have an NAD-specific enzyme which clearly is involved in energy storage, an energy supply, because NADH specifically is oxidized in the mitochondria through the cytochrome system to produce ATP. The other enzyme is a synthetic enzyme because most of the plants and most of the organisms that make their own glutamate use the NADPH enzyme. In other words, they use the reduced form of the coenzyme to supply the hydrogen for the reduction of alpha-ketoglutarate to make glutamate. That's the synthetic pathway. And for example, E. coli, which makes its own glutamate, has only the NADPH enzyme. And that is true of all organisms that have only one glutamate dehydrogenase, which is used synthetically, uses the NADP enzyme. And it is a generalization for all dehydrogenases that those that use NADPH are synthetic, those that use NAD for substrates supply energy for the ATP mechanism. So that's why we started to study both. Well, it turned out the NAD enzyme was small, and the NADPH enzyme, rather, is small and is homologous to the vertebrate enzyme. The NAD enzyme of Neurospora is quite different. But that's another story. So we ended up doing both, which took a long time. And, of course, that was the work that I was doing primarily as I was scaling down the laboratory, getting ready to retire. That was our last job.
Who was working with you on that?
The two people principally who worked on it were Brian Austin, who was from England, and who's back at St. George's Hospital in London as a research biochemist, and Maggie Happerland, who carried on and is now in our Department of Medicine as a research biochemist in the Division of Cardiology. She's here. The role of glutamate, why mammals have an enzyme that works on both, is a good story in itself, but has nothing to do with us. That's metabolic biochemistry.
How much contact did you have with undergraduates? Did you have undergraduates working in your group from time to time, or did you?
We would occasionally have a summer student come in from, usually it had some good training in chemistry to spend the summer, but generally working with one of the people in the lab, not directly with me. I had no real contact with undergraduates here at UCLA, except occasionally when I was a guest lecturer for somebody in one of their courses. And in Utah, I had very little also. So I really didn't teach undergraduates from the time I left Columbia in 1938, a long time ago.
I have a number of questions relating to your, what I'll call, extracurricular activities. But before we look at that, is there anything else along the lines we've been discussing at this point that you would like to add?
No, I think the scientific information is all in the reviews. Personal information, I think you've got pretty well before. I think that covers it pretty well. Let me ask you what time you want to get. You go driving back to San Diego?
I'm driving back to San Diego.
What time do you want to get away from there?
I'm not going out, flying out till tomorrow morning, so I'm in no big hurry to go back, but I don't know what traffic will be like later on in the day.
Traffic between 4:30 and 7 will be heavy.
Okay.
It'll move, but it's heavy.
Sounds like back home.
Well, it's worse since the earthquake.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because the number of routes has been diminished, and in many cases where work is going on, there are one or two lanes available instead of four or five.
Well, just the detour I had to make on 10, which wasn't all that bad, but I thought, boy, if this were in a rush hour situation, this would be a nightmare.
We avoid it. We had to go out to Pasadena a couple of times in the last couple of months since the earthquake, and we just use the city streets until we get past the main break, which is La Cienega Boulevard, and then go on 10 out there. The worst spots are some of the spots to the north, fortunately, not to the south. But it's all affected because people are using different routes.
I understand the rail commutation has increased.
Oh, of course. Maybe people will have learned something. I hope.
In terms of some of your extracurricular activities, there are three in particular that I was interested in. One, of course, goes way back, and that's the International Union of Biochemistry, your activities. Number of places there, especially with international conferences. Do you have any comments about those years?
Well, the way I got involved, I guess, was in 1957 or 58. I'd been appointed to the U.S. National Committee for the International Union of Biochemistry, which was made up of representatives nominated by the Biochemistry Division of the ACS and the ASBC. who was going to represent biochemistry. Well, there were two different groups, and it was done through the National Academy, who always appointed one member, so that there would be some kind of a balance. And the chairmanship was the senior person from the group to succeed the previous chairman from the other group. Well, it so happened that the turn came of the representative nominated from the ASBC, and the senior person was Connie Elvium, and he became president of the University of Wisconsin and resigned. He had no time to spend in the U.S. National Committee, so I became chairman of the committee. As chairman of the committee, I automatically became a delegate to IUB at the next General Assembly, which was going to take place in Moscow in 1961. In the meantime, and the history is an amusing one, the last previous Congress in chemistry of 1951, during which we were embarrassed by the fact that our State Department refused to give visas to a large number of Europeans to attend the Congress. This was the McCarthy period. And we in biochemistry had made up our minds that we were not going to hold a Congress in the United States until this situation changed. Even though at that time we were already by far the dominant country in the world in biochemistry. So the previous congresses of biochemistry had been in Cambridge, Paris, Brussels, Vienna. It all started after the war, of course. Because prior to the war, biochemistry was essentially part of the physiology congresses. We set up a separate union right after the war. So the question was, with things changing, now that John Foster Dulles was dead and Christian Herta had become Secretary of State, and it was the last days of the Eisenhower administration, we decided we would hold the Congress in the United States if we could have a clear inkling that there would be no problems. So one day when I was in Washington together with the Foreign Secretary of the Academy and a couple of other people, an appointment was arranged to meet with Mr. Herta. And we got along very well because I reminded him that his uncle had been the founder of the Journal of Biological Chemistry, for whom he was named. And that in reading the minutes of the early history of the JBC and its expenditures, his nephew had been paid some money for helping to wrap and mail the first issues of the JBC. He laughed like hell. And he knew what we were coming over to see him about. And we then presented the problem, that it had been a terrible embarrassment for us and for our country to have to go through the situation where a large number of very distinguished scientists from various countries had been kept out of the United States in 1951. And it wasn't the Russians who were kept out. It was people from France, many of whom had joined the Communist Party during the underground, for example, like Jacques Monod. It was people like Per Edman in Sweden who had circulated the petitions to stop above-ground nuclear testing. Anybody who signed those petitions had been blacklisted by our State Department. We had a long list. I was on the executive board of the section at that time, the biochemistry section of the ACS, and I had been responsible for organizing two symposia. One for the, I don't know whether you were involved in that Congress at all, if you remember. It was the 25th anniversary of IUPAC and the 75th anniversary of the ACS.
In 51.
51. It was the 75th anniversary. So we had the first week was ACS. The following week was IUPAC, consecutive meetings. And I organized two symposia, one ACS, one IUPAC. Since I was on the executive board, it was the sole real responsibility of being a member of the executive committee is to work, organize a symposium. Well, the symposium on the ACS side was no problem. They were all Americans. The symposium that I organized on the IUPAC side, two of the people that I invited were blacklisted. And I get the telephone calls, you got to fill up the program. I said, like hell, I'm filling up the program. I'm not going to fill out the program. I'm going to get up there and announce why our speakers aren't coming. And in the case of Per Edmund, I pointed out that Per Edmund had been a postdoctoral fellow in the United States for a couple of years working at the Rockefeller. And was now not allowed back and explained the reason why. So that's where we had the thing. So I explained all of this to Mr. Herter, who knew nothing about it, obviously. He said, I assure you that any bona fide biochemist who wants to attend the Biochemistry Congress in the United States will be given a visa, even if it's only a limited visa for the time of the Congress. I said, that's all I can ask. I can't ask you to change laws, but I can ask you to make it feasible. So we held the first major Congress in the United States after the McCarthy period. So I went to Moscow in 61 and invited the Congress to Haldia. Excuse me. We signed contracts for, I've forgotten how many thousand rooms in the New York Hilton and in the Americana, which were still holes in the ground. It was the only way we could have the meeting, to get enough space in Midtown Manhattan at that time. In the meantime, we had looked all over the United States, and the only place where there were enough beds and enough hotel space and convention facility was going to be in New York, because there were two brand new hotels going up where we could hold the entire meeting. So we signed the contract. And we went to Moscow and we invited, with a letter of invitation from the mayor of New York and the governor of New York State. And we was accepted, and that was it. So then we came the time to plan the meeting in New York, and I appointed Stanford Moore as chairman of the local organizing committee. He was on the spot and could do it. And we appointed the committees to select the invited speakers and to arrange things. And I think the most amusing part of the story was to take care of the finances. Europe was still pretty poor at that time. Japan was still pretty poor at that time. They were still recovering. And we knew that the only way we'd get any young people to the meeting was to pay travel and to try to get inexpensive space for them to stay. So we had a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Congress to decide how we were going to handle finances, and aside from going to the NIH and the NSF, which I wrote the applications, and that was no problem, we also decided we wanted to do some reasonable entertaining. And that the travel help or invited speakers was easily, we could use NIH or NSF money for that, but that was specific. That's for the benefit of American science, that we invite distinguished speakers from the group. But for younger people, you can't justify it anyway. So Mel Calvin, bless his soul, came up with a bright idea. We were meeting at the Academy in Washington, and Mel says, let me call Max Tischler, who's research director at Merck, and explain the situation. And Mel Calvin came back 20 minutes later and said, Max Tischler has agreed to serve as chairman of the Finance Committee beside if he's allowed a free hand to appoint the own members of the committee himself. We said, of course. And later on we found out what Max had done is he had appointed them as members of the Finance Committee, the research directors of all the major pharmaceutical and chemical houses in the United States. He called one meeting and explained what the situation was as to why this was the first chemistry congress since 51 and the first biochemistry congress, and he assured the people there that it would never be another one in our lifetimes. Excuse me.